Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Alistair Nisbet. How are you, Alistair?
I'm very good, thanks, Chris.
Excellent. And you're from the Climate Wine Consultant, which is a consultancy.
That's right.
And you're a doctor, so I should really call you Dr. Alistair Nisbet. Yeah. Do you like being called doctor?
To be honest, I don't really use it that much, I don't mind.
Medical doctors do, and I always think of medical doctors as not real doctors because they haven't done a proper
they don't
research.
They don't do PhDs. They're not done a PhD.
No. As far as I'm concerned, they're an undergraduate with 4 years on-the-job training, like a plumber.
So. I'm sure there are some people who'd agree and some who wouldn't. But yeah.
I've just offended a load of doctors on listening to the show, but that's all right. Okay, so what we want to talk about today is a little bit about the weather and the changing weather. It's been a long time since we've looked at climate change in the UK. Well, climate change in general, and we haven't really looked at climate change in the UK specifically. But before we do that, you were saying last week that the British people love their weather. Because you said we get so much of it. Well, everybody gets weather. I think we get the change in the weather a lot. It's quite changeable.
Yeah, that's right.
So where does the weather come from?
So, you know, England being an island has a lot of weather variability and it can change very quickly and it changes, you know, really depending on where you are. But where does it come from? In general, one of the reasons we get so many different weather patterns is because we've got different weather patterns competing, if you like, for space over England, over the UK. We're this island stuck between a massive water mass and then the mainland Europe, and weather patterns, conversion, fight for space over the UK. And, we also experience jet streams and pressures like other countries, but because of our location, it means we get a lot of variable weather.
I'm not a climatologist by any stretch, but I've seen programs looking at things like the jet stream, and above the jet stream it tends to be cold, and below the jet stream it seems to be nicer. And that jet stream in the UK tends to hang around just below Scotland, Midlands area around there, but sometimes it comes all the way down and there's, London's freezing, and then it goes up, and even in Scotland it gets warm,
absolutely.
And where it is positioned just seems to follow chaos theory,
Well, I think that it's probably
butterflies in Japan is setting the weather.
We're obsessed about the weather, and I'll be honest, I should imagine that England or the UK is one of the harder places in the world to forecast weather for. We're not the California, we're not Bordeaux, we're not Sahara Desert. We've got all these different competing patterns of airspace and all these different variables you have to consider. So forecasting weather in England's probably a big challenge compared to other places.
Yeah. Okay. So weather is quite variable. But in the paper you looked at, the weather over two time periods, and you compared them and you tried to work out what was the biggest influence on the weather, and then maybe look at what was going forward in terms of climate change, which was quite interesting. In general, what's happening to the trend in the UK weather?
Trend in terms of, I guess it's more a climate trend. So the trend, if you like, over a longer period, sort of 20, 30-year periods, we looked at the growing season, so April to October, and we looked at what's happened going back actually sort of 50, 60 years during the growing season. And what we saw was if you were to draw a straight line through, data for every year on a graph, you'd see a slight increase in temperature. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't see too much difference in terms of rainfall. Mm-hmm. I should caveat by saying this is just for the southeast, south central England we're talking about here. Might be slightly different elsewhere. We also saw very, very minor but not statistically significant decrease in air frost days in April and May, which is...
An air frost, what's that, where you don't get a ground frost?
No, an air frost is purely relative to where you measure it. So when we talk about air frost, we're talking about measurements between 1.5 and 2 meters above ground. Okay. When we talk about ground frost, we talk about measurements just above the surface of the ground.
Frost 0 degrees or lower?
Yeah, so here we're talking about radiation frost, so we need specific conditions for radiation frost, and we're talking about how often they occur during April and May, because that's critical to bud burst and the potential negative effect on buds and yield. So we saw a very minor decrease during April and May. So trends are useful to look at direction of things, but But I think what was more interesting and what was more probably useful to a grower is, for all of those variables, there's a lot of variability for year on year.
Yeah.
So this trend line, if you like, we're putting that on a graph. We're talking about averages. But actually what's interesting is going up and down year on year and looking at the differences, because ultimately that's what affects yields and viability.
Standard deviation, as they say, isn't it? You know, you've got big standard deviation.
That's right.
So you might have an average, but the difference can be quite large.
Yeah, the average over a 30-year period is not really much use to a guy who's wanting to predict his yield or project his yield for you know, this coming year, or know when to spray, or et cetera, et cetera.
Okay, so what you're saying is there's a big deviation, so therefore the local weather that year is going to have a much bigger effect than the climate necessarily.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we talk about climates, we're talking about long-term averages, you know, 20, 30 years maybe. Now, they're useful in the sense that they give us a direction. We know where things are going. We can see the growing season's warming up over the, you know, has been warming up and projected to warm up in the future. But we can also see within that, it comes back to this issue of we're an island with a lot of weather. The weather really is the critical factor to high and low yields. And some of the lowest yielding years in the UK are attributed to a single weather event, a frost, for example, or extreme heavy rainfall during flowering, as happened in 2012, which, you know, heavy rainfall comes with clouds, overcast conditions, you know, poor conditions flowering. Conversely, you know, when we have a stable year with dry, warm, sunny conditions, you know, we get higher yields, higher quality. So,
okay, so
it's a trade-off.
The main weathers that I think of is, as you say, frost during bud burst, and also during flowering, you don't want rain because cultivars, varieties, they fertilize through wind. Their vines are a wind fertilizer as opposed to bees. So if it's wet, all the pollen gets pulled out of the air because of the rain. Is that? And also the flowers get beaten up by
I was going to say that we have to also look at the, you know, just the physical damage that rain can do in, you know, but as you say, when you get rain, you also get overcast conditions, dull conditions, just not conducive to even flowering. It creates a lot of difficult conditions.
Frost and bud burst, rain during flowering.
And we also have to look, I think, more and more at conditions during maturation as the berries are ripening. So, for example, if you take last year, there was quite a lot of frost at the beginning of the year.
Yep.
So that really helped suppress yields. And there was a bit of rain around June, which, you know, likewise did the same. But then we had a fantastic warm, dry, sunny maturation period. So we ended up with low yields and hopefully really high quality. So we have to look at different aspects of the seasons and what happens when.
Okay. And you're saying that the temperature's creeping up, which is nice. The rainfalls doesn't appear to be changing that much. We've still got the same, roughly the same amount of rain. And is the frost the same?
There's some different interesting areas to talk about there. So just taking temperature, that's probably the easiest. Yeah, over time we're seeing temperature increase. And that in theory leads to, you know, more viability for viticulture. Rainfall, not much change over time, a lot of variability from year to year. What was really interesting in this paper, we looked at rainfall volumes in Southeast England on a month-by-month basis. Now, we know that, as we've just discussed, rainfall around flowering is not good, full stop, when we get a lot of rain or a long period of rain. And what we found is really there's no trend over time of that rainfall in June, when flowering commonly occurs, increasing or decreasing. And what that tells you is the risk of rainfall and the negative effect on yield is constant. Okay, there's no increase or decrease. Some years will be good, some years will be low, but there isn't a trend up or down.
Yeah.
So that's important to note. In terms of frost, I think one of the most interesting factors is, frost levels might be decreasing. Frost temperatures might be decreasing slightly. But this really interesting factor that as temperatures warm, buds burst a little bit earlier. If buds burst earlier, they're more susceptible to frost. So when a frost does hit, there's still that risk. So actually, it's a counterintuitive situation. And I think it's probably a bit of a falsehood for people who think that, you know, warming temperatures means lower frost risk. The level of risk, it might not happen as often, but when it happens, the risk is higher.
Okay, so just to recap on that, so it's warmer, bud bursts earlier, so you're into the colder part of the year anyway, so you're going to get the same risk of frost, is it?
You're into the part of the year when frost occurs and when you can have a negative impact on buds bursting.
So in actual fact, as it gets warmer, there is actually a greater risk of frost, or do you think it's
I wouldn't say it's greater. It's just that the risk hasn't really diminished.
Okay.
Unless you can delay bud burst. But if you're not doing anything to delay bud burst, as buds burst earlier, the chance of a frost happening means that the impact on the bud would be the same.
Yeah. How do you delay bud burst? Is it pruning or?
Yeah, various different pruning. There's certain applications you can put on vines, but predominantly, yeah, pruning or looking at, well, it comes down a little bit to what varietal you've got planted, but different mechanisms.
Yeah, yeah, okay. All right. What about things like, as we move more to Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, they must need it a little bit warmer than before. So like Bacchus, I imagine has got an early bud burst, whereas a more marginal grape variety will bud burst a little bit later.
For any varietal, I mean, if you term them marginal now and you look at the long-term trends, we would see them becoming more suited to conditions over time, which is great. But it doesn't really get away from this issue that, some years are going to be cooler, wetter, other years are going to be warmer, drier.
Yeah, okay. So it sounds like with increasing temperature, the variability in the yield won't change.
That's right. And this issue of variability is critical and links in with what we talked about last week when we talked about mapping.
Yep.
And one of the factors that we're going to integrate into the mapping work is how variable an area is. So if we find that an aerial, as I mentioned before, maybe parts of East Anglia are less variable year on year, you could argue that with lower variability, they're more suited to viticulture because the argument follows through that they would have more consistent yields. Mm-hmm. In other words, conditions in certain areas in the UK don't vary as much year on year as they do in other areas. So at the moment, we've just looked at South East England and we can tell you what the variability is there. But that might be lower or higher if we look at the Midlands, Southwest, East Anglia, et cetera, et cetera.
I suppose the thing is, if you don't, using frost as an example, if you only get frost occasionally every now and then, you're probably not going to have the same equipment in place to deal with the frost. Whereas if you know every year you're going to get hit by frost, you'll have proper metering and monitoring and you'll have the right equipment in the vineyard so that frost becomes less of an issue than if you had it just occasionally.
Well, that's certainly what we find working with vineyards, is that those vineyards that are more susceptible to radiation frost risk tend to be the vineyards that have got protection in place. However, just because a vineyard might only be at risk of an average of one frost event per year doesn't mean the potential effect on their yield is any lower, because it only takes one frost event per year. So we have to look at, we've got high resolution models of historic temperatures, and we have to look at how low temperatures go and how long they stay there, as well as how often they occur. So you might have a vineyard site, for example, and in the area the vineyard's in, it only gets an average of one radiation frost event in April every year, but that could be -5°C. You might have another area that might have 10 events per year, but they're all about -0.1 or 2. So there's a trade-off again between looking at these different variables and working out what risk level is. And with frost, I've got to say, if you're at risk of just one frost event per year, your risk is just the same as someone who's at risk of 10 frost events per year.
Okay. Because
it only takes that one frost event.
One good one. Yeah, okay. The other thing in your paper you talked about with regards to yield was frost bud burst, but also rain coming up to harvest had quite a negative effect on yield. What's going on there?
I think the rain coming up to harvest is not necessarily an effect on yield. It's more effect on berry quality, an impact on berry quality. It could mean, for example, that, as I say, with rain you get sort of overcast, dull conditions, cooler temperatures. It could just mean ripening maturation hasn't advanced to the same level as it would do with different conditions. It could also physically affect vines and varieties and promote sort of disease pressure within a vineyard, which has a negative effect. It can also affect, the simple process of harvest and quality of fruit at harvest, and all of those factors taken together, rain during or pre-harvest is not ideal. And most growers would look for a drier period before they actually send guys out there to start harvesting, yeah.
You did say that maybe the bud burst is hitting a bit earlier, and normally your harvest time is set by a particular number of days from bud burst to harvest.
Yep.
If you're moving earlier in the season, you could potentially leave your grapes on the vine a little bit longer, get more physiological ripeness, you know, flavor ripeness and sugar ripeness.
Yep.
So you could land up with higher or more flavorsome, higher alcohol quality grapes, less chaptalization if you picked later. Are you finding that that option becomes more realistic to producers?
Yeah, it should do. I mean, if you were to compare, let's say, for example, your, you know, theoretically, your perfect year 30 years ago for a harvest versus your perfect year now for a harvest, now you would have a longer growing season. And what that means, as you rightly say, is that that's beneficial for berries on vines and theory beneficial for quality.
It also gives the winemaker or the vineyard operator an opportunity because they could pick early where they normally would.
Pick when the grapes are ready.
But yeah. Even if it's a little bit wet, they can continue spraying to manage the disease pressure and hope that it stops raining later on so they can then stop spraying and pick. Because you can't – that's the problem with around harvest time, isn't it? You've got to stop spraying because
yeah, I think about three weeks beforehand.
And that's when you need the really good weather because, you know, the vines are sitting there naked.
That's right.
They're just waiting to get diseased.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if it's a problem, then you're in real –
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it comes back – weather forecasting is important and probably an undervalued service in the UK.
Says a man selling a climate bike.
Yeah, absolutely right. I did a survey about 3 years ago of producers and asked them where they're getting weather forecast information from. And, you know, people are relying on things like the BBC website, you know, which is fine, or other services, which is absolutely fine. What there isn't out there until literally now, because we're in the process of developing it now, is something that gives much more site-specific weather forecasting information. We're actually, we've got some funding from DEFRA, and we're in the process of developing an app which will push out weather forecasting services for vineyards in the UK. So very specific. It's going to be out in the next 2 months.
Oh, okay. What's the app called?
It's going to be called Climate Vine.
Climate Vine.
It's going to be out in the next couple of months. We're developing it now. And on via that app, people are going to be able to access live weather information, but also forecast information, and there'll be warnings on there about spray times, etc. And we hope that, you know, it's a small step, but we hope that will enable growers to have more confidence in terms of deciding when they should harvest or could harvest, when they should spray, etc., etc.
Yeah, okay. I suppose, well, the thing about the weather is it is a really important part, both in terms of yield and quality of the wines. And I remember when I did a series of interviews in Marlborough with Stu Powell.
Yes.
Yeah, Stu. And he was doing a similar type of thing where he was selling a service to vineyards to forecast the frost and give them frost warnings.
Yeah.
I was surprised that there was no one doing it in the UK at that point, but there wasn't. And I suppose that's one of the things about an industry is it grows up and becomes more mature, the ability to provide services to that industry, because it gets bigger, becomes more valuable, and therefore that increases the quality of the wines again.
Yeah, it does. It does. And, you know, it's a natural progression. But as the sector grows, two things are happening. One, sort of, you know, need for services are becoming more apparent, such as the services we provide. But it's the swings and roundabouts to a degree, because to provide services, certainly the sort that we would provide, we need data from vineyards. We need to know what the relationship between weather and climate are. And as we get more and more vineyards, we get more and more vineyards providing us with valuable data. We can therefore improve our forecasting, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a natural kind of progression, I think, into these services, and they'll improve over time.
How many temperature readings do you think a typical vineyard needs?
Depends on the size of the vineyard, depends on the topography of the vineyard, depends on what their previous experiences have been with things like frost risk. But a lot of vineyards don't have any weather monitoring devices in. Quite a lot will have a single weather station in. Now, a single weather station has its use, but what we push and what we promote is for vineyards to spend less money and put in multiple sensors for temperatures and relative humidity, so we can actually develop a 3D map of their site showing the warmer, cooler areas. We can then model airflow. We can then model where the cold air accumulation areas are and where the frost risk areas are. We can then recommend with confidence what goes into those areas or what goes into the vineyard to help the businesses protect themselves against frost risk.
And frost risk seems to be the one that is where the quality of weather forecasting is low, because it is quite site specific. You know,
it is very site specific.
I don't know. The BBC team seems to be able to tell me when it's going to rain pretty accurately around where my house is.
Yeah.
But frost seems to be very site specific.
Yeah. So there's different things we can do there. You're right in that, you know, weather forecasting, we always have to factor in scale and granularity of the information that's been pushed out. And, it, you know, if there's a threat for a frost within a region overnight, it means your vineyard might or might not be affected. And what we do is we develop, as I say, really high resolution. You know, we're talking 1 meter by 1 meter gridded models of site combined with frost risk information to tell us if a frost risk in the area occurs, what's the likelihood it's going to affect your vineyard site and where would it affect?
We'll jump back to frost next week, but just finishing up on the discussion paper that you had earlier, one of the things that you did was did a questionnaire to wineries and winemakers about what they thought.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the things they were talking about was, you know, do you think climate change is going to improve your vineyard or make it worse, etc.
It was really interesting. Let's caveat this first of all by saying I did the survey just after 2012, which was one of the worst years on record. Yeah. Because we had a terrible flowering and maturation period. But the results are interesting. So, and a bit counterintuitive, a bit unexpected maybe, in that actually people growing grapes in the UK who responded to the survey, a lot of them saw climate change as both a threat and an opportunity. They saw the risks as well as the advantages. And for someone outside the industry, that might seem odd, because they might hear about vineyards being established and assume that this is related to changing climate conditions. Yet interviewing people already in the industry, what they were rightly doing was pointing out that, yeah, on average conditions might be changing. Good years might be coming more frequent. They might not be. But there are still poor years. And it goes back to what we talked about earlier and last week, that, you know, businesses have to be able to build into their business models buffers for these poor years and low yields, because they're going to happen. Comes back to this issue of weather again. So, yeah, so the perception, you know, perception of climate change amongst growers is interesting. And I think it's probably very realistic that every year isn't rosy. There are difficult years. And it probably, you know, more than anything, certainly grounds people in the reality of the fact that we're still at the margins of commercial viability for viticulture. And we have to differentiate between the really high quality wine, sparkling wine that's been produced, and the businesses behind those.
And the viability of the businesses.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And there's not much data out there about that. I think we can say, you know, the number of vineyards are increasing, the vineyards that are out there are expanding, which all indicates positive times, investment, growing businesses, an increasing economic viability. And, you know, there's a relationship between economic viability, the high quality of the produce, the marketing that goes with that produce, and then, you know, the reality of the conditions we're growing in. Mm. Make hay while the sun shines is kind of the phrase that springs to mind.
Yeah.
Because that, you know, so business models, business planning is really important. And for anyone thinking of setting up a vineyard, you know, get that nailed first before you get excited about planting vines.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. All right, Alistair, we'll wrap it up there.
Thank you.
Cheers very much.